You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, we'll be looking at how Canada is reacting to a foiled terrorist attack from earlier this week. Was the nation prepared for the threat? My guests Thomas Lewis in Toronto, plus Matt Alagaya and Josh Fennett here in the studio will be discussing this and some of the week's other top stories, including why a right-wing British newspaper is sharing stories with the official newspaper of China's Communist Party, whether London has a future as a design city, and we'll also find something to say about a shark that could be more than 500 years old. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House, and as ever on a Friday, my guests are Monocle staff. Here in London, we have Matt Alagaya. Hello, Matt.
Hello, how are you?
Very good indeed. We have Josh Fennett. Hello, Josh.
Hello, Steve.
And winging his way all the way over from Toronto in our bureau there, we have Thomas Lewis. Hello, good afternoon, Thomas.
Good afternoon, gents. How are you?
We're all very good. Now, before we start with the more serious subjects, Josh, Matt, a good week. We're at the end of now. Just to put people in, to explain where we are in the cycle, we're working on the October issue. The September issue
came into the office. Very exciting.
It's a big one, isn't it, Josh?
And doesn't it just pop as well? That beautiful kind of fluoro colour on the cover, invoking people to go out there and start their own businesses. I'm considering it, actually, after this week, I'll be honest. the copy deadline for the October issue's in. It's looking great, themed around the idea of style, and hopefully we'll come up with just as stylish a cover. What do you think?
Let's hope so. I'm sure we will. And Matt, the September issue, it's got the Entrepreneur's Guide in. It's all about getting out there and, as Josh says, starting your own business.
Absolutely. It's a bit of a kind of call to action, I think, for us. We want to tell people, that business that you've always dreamed of starting, whether it's a shop or a restaurant or something bigger, now's the time to do it. There's no time like the present. So, we have a lot of kind of tips in there, some inspiration, some instruction. It's all good.
And Tom, in Toronto, hello.
Hello there.
You're working on something even bigger and more special, aren't you? You can give it just a little flavour of it now.
A little sneak peek, yeah. So the ball is rolling ahead of our November issue, of course, which is a Canada Nation special. And yeah, we're getting pretty excited here in the Toronto Bureau. I think things are starting to sort of flesh themselves out. And of course, every section will be jam-packed with the brightest and the best that Canada has to offer today. So yes, we are starting in earnest on putting that together, which will be this year's November issue.
Excellent. Good. We'll be covering everything from Toronto to Vancouver to Newfoundland to where else is there? All sorts of places, Tom.
Everything in between. It's a very large country, yes.
Even Edmonton. I say even Edmonton because, it has been known as Deadmonton, and there are lots of Canadians who would be perhaps surprised that we're doing a report from there, but we'll even be reporting from there, won't we?
We will indeed.
Okay. Well, look, we're going to actually start in Canada today, where a foiled terrorist plot on Wednesday is now meaning that the nation is beginning to ask questions about the effectiveness of its security services. Police shot and killed Aaron Driver in Strathroy, Ontario, who is allegedly less than 72 hours away from carrying out an attack. He detonated an explosive device as police intercepted his journey in a cab. Tom Lewis, first of all, how has this story been covered in the Canadian press?
It's been covered in quite a measured way, I think, Steve. I think the shock that people feel at this is pretty clear as well. And it's brought up a lot of issues, both from, security, as you mentioned there, also kind of Canada's role in this broader picture that, has been unfurling in grim and grotesque ways over the past year or so. you know, Canada, I think, has tried to sort of forge its own path in many ways, kind of in the light of, say, the threats that, that European nations have faced, even the growing sort of narrative in the United States as well. I think the just the urgency of this and just how imminent it appears, although we don't fully know the details yet, this alleged attack was, I think really is quite a shocking thing to Canadians. Of course, in 2013, we had a thwarted plot in Victoria in British Columbia, where two apparent sympathisers to Al-Qaeda were planning to plant bombs within the legislative building on Canada Day. Of course, then in 2014, we had the lone gunman who attacked the Parliament building in Ottawa. I think what, you know, people are sort of thinking now is, and I think it is impressive just how measured the response has been so far from both Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his cabinet ministers and members of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police too, who made the official sort of statements on this on Wednesday and Thursday, is that this is quite a calm and measured response. And I think that they are urging people, maybe quite differently, say, to the United States, to, you know, to assess and to discuss kind of the implications of this, but to not sort of, you know, create this kind of great uncertainty that we've seen, say, in communities in the United States, for example, in San Bernardino or in Texas, for example, following sort of similar incidents, apparently similar incidents there.
And Josh, this also brings up the issue that we've seen elsewhere, particularly in France recently, where there were, you know, where there are 11,000 people on the terror watch list in France. You know, this man in Canada was known to the authorities. He was under a court order which was restricting his movements. It just goes to show how much of a challenge this can be, even when people are known to the authorities.
Well, I think as a broader context to this, when Justin Trudeau was elected in October 2015, one of his pledges was to scale back Canada's combative role against the Islamic State. And as you mentioned, there were certain watches put on this man, a thing known as a peace bond, which restricted his use of mobile phones, meant that he had to seek approval to buy one, but also his posts online. And it seems to me that social media activities would actually be a rather good way of monitoring someone's intent, and he's one of two people on this list. So it's not that I'm questioning Canada's mounted police's ability to manage these things. It's just that I think that he wasn't watched closely enough in a circumstance where it appears he could have been.
Matt, Tom, did you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I did. And that's, I think, it's a good point that Josh brings up, because that's almost the central question now that's being brought up. So in the light of what happened in Victoria back in 2013, there was a big narrative that said, you know, the case against them collapsed because there was this, basically this concern that the, you know, the balance between surveillance and freedom and those kind of things, you know, just didn't weigh out. Now here, of course, people are saying, well, listen, the foot was far too off the pedal the other way. So, you know, we're looking at whether the peace bonds, as Josh pointed out, are are an effective tool, basically. Aaron Driver's father has come out and given some interviews to the press saying that, you know, he wished his son had been forced to go into these sort of de-radicalization classes, which have become a bit of a political football in their own right as Canada discusses this big, wide-ranging security bill that has become very contentious here. So whether that, this incident on Wednesday and the aftermath of it, you know, helps sharpen the sort of political focus here, I think there will be a sense of urgency now, kind of in those debates, to really try and sort of firm up whether it is the peace bond, whether it's something new. But of course, it's the balance that's going to be really tricky. You know, that's why I think this measured response so far has been quite effective in its way, I suppose, in trying to keep these things in a sort of, you know, in without sort of raising the tenor too much, kind of given that this attack was thwarted.
And Matt, there's a broader question here as well about the difference between political violence and sociopathy, between, you know, people that really are linked to international terrorist groups and people who are angry, whether that is angry at not being able to get a girlfriend or angry about not being able to get a job, or are, you know, the sorts of people that were dubbed loners before, the people that were, you know, whether it was the Unabomber in the US or whether it was people in school shootings in the US. There seems to be a bit of a merging now of what these two things are. And we're saying this is terrorism, we're saying this is Islamist terrorism, and yet sometimes that's just a bit of a convenient label that everyone, including the attempted killers and the killers themselves, put on it.
Absolutely. It's a really interesting point you make there. I mean, the rise of the lone wolf attack is something we've seen across Europe recently. But, you know, that you're absolutely right that things, you know, organizations like Islamic State, they feed off people's fears and anger, and there will be a lot of loners who are drawn towards something like that, and it's not necessarily a kind of an ideological thing. It might well just be, as you say, a kind of a lone wolf who wants to make a statement in an awful way.
And there's another thing here, Josh, as well, which is in terms of how we report on these issues and how we deal with them. Because if you look at the figures, you know, the number of people killed in terrorist attacks is lower now than it was in the 1970s, and yet the fear is greater. Now, is that because we know more about what's going on around the world than we did before, the communication is greater, or is it also partly, you know, the world is changing so fast that we feel that the things we'd normally cling to, the things that would sort of help define who we are, aren't necessarily there as much?
Well, it's a multifaceted question, which I fear I won't have full time to answer. But I think you make a very good point about the paucity of terrorist attacks compared to previous years. The fact more people are killed by guns fired by infants in America than are by terrorist attacks. I think what the ISIS narrative does is gives people something to be afraid of. And unfortunately, we see that being seized on by populists. We see politicians talking about it. And consequently, we in the media are forced to cover it. So I think the only thing that we can do is try and be even-handed and try and raise the points that you've rightly identified. Whether or not this gentleman identified with IS or not, it appears that he did. He is a lone wolf. He is an unstable individual. And the only thing that we can focus on are the structural ways of dealing with this before it happens, and hoping to thwart like this more attempts before they happen.
Tom, there's been in Germany, there's been a response from right-wing politicians at a regional level talking about, for example, we need to ban burqas and niqabs, as if that has in some way been linked to the attacks in Germany, which they haven't. Has there been any sort of discussion in Canada at the moment where politicians have tried to link Canada's openness, and Canada's arguably been, you know, up there with Germany as the most open country when it's come to refugees from Syria, for instance, and these sorts of attacks?
It's an interesting question, because I think the short answer is no, actually, especially now after Wednesday's events here. I think the political side of things has been very careful not to draw very sweeping statements and not to try and inflame, you know, a situation that will quite rightly have people very nervous. Now, during the general election campaign back last year in 2015, there was a big debate in Quebec about the niqab and about the way Muslim women dressed and whether there should be a ban in place and those kind of things. Now, that was seen at the time as being a political move on then Prime Minister Stephen Harper's part, rather than an actual sort of tapping into a mood or an appetite that existed there. Those rules haven't come into place. They haven't really gone much further, as far as I understand it. You know, I think, just to go back quickly, Steve, to what you were saying about the way, you know, we cover these things, I think that's what I've been quite impressed with by the Canadian coverage of this so far, is that it's been very measured and it's been very quick to try and answer questions that I suppose these newspapers, these TV channels feel the people will have. So a lot of the newspapers today have quite interesting explainers of what the peace bonds are, for example, of what we knew about this young man. And I think when you look at, say, the US coverage of attacks that have happened recently, you know, there's been a great speed to try and characterize what these attacks were. You know, for example, from the attacks in Orlando at the nightclub there, from the attacks in San Bernardino, there was a great drawing of conclusions before we even really knew what the situation was. I don't think we are experiencing that in the Canadian media, and I think that is a very positive thing, because I think at the end of the day, you know, we are in uncertain times. Canada may have felt slightly immune from it so far, despite, as you said, its open arms policy, you know, frankly, to refugees and those in similar sort of difficult situations from around the world. I think, you know, there is, as I said before, a measured tone to this. And I think that that will be, you know, a very useful and important thing going forward as, you know, the response sort of, you know, gets fleshed out, I suppose, and starts becoming more concrete.
Okay, we will leave it there. Let's talk now about two very different newspapers. One is the right-wing, populist British newspaper, the Daily Mail, which is, I think it's fair to say, has sort of made a bit of a splash in its digital form as well. It is now arguably the most read newspaper in the English-speaking world. And the other is the official mouthpiece of the Communist Party in China, the People's Daily. Now, Matt Alagaya, you would perhaps be hard-pressed to find two media publications as diametrically opposed as these two, and yet they seem to have struck up an unusual partnership. Tell us more.
It's quite an astonishing story, actually. I mean, it seems to be going, have been going for about a year. This is effectively 40 stories a week get swapped between, and it's Mail Online, so not, it's the website, not the paper. But Mail Online swaps around 40 stories a week with this the Chinese newspaper, The People's Daily. There's no money exchanging hands, so on that side, I guess you could say that, you know, the Mail has kind of covered itself in a sense. But it is it's a very, very kind of interesting and bizarre collaboration. I mean, it's slightly kind of classical Mail style, I guess. It's commercially quite sensible, but ethically quite dubious. I mean, obviously, you know, this is the official mouthpiece of the Communist Party, of course, as you said. And the Mail is a staunch advocate of press freedom around the world, and particularly in Britain. And they should really balk at the idea of collaborating with the official mouthpiece of this regime. And, you know, journalists in China are under incredible pressures and, you know, basically told what to say. So it's a strange one, and not a particularly healthy one, I think.
Josh, it's slightly curious as well, because, I mean, first of all, as you'd expect for a partnership with a communist Chinese newspaper, everyone's been very tight-lipped about it. No one's really explained what's going on. But one wonders what the Mail gets out of this, because actually, when you look at the stories that they've used from the People's Daily, they're stories that other newspapers have carried without having to do any sort of deal whatsoever with the People's Daily.
I mean, I don't think it's a very coded coded arrangement at all. The Mail's online editorial chief, Martin Clark, came out in deeply coded words and said, "China is an increasing source of stories for outward-looking global publishers like the Daily Mail," by which I think he forgot to add readers. So I think they're looking for extra readership in this newly styled red top, if you'll excuse the pun. But it's a little bit it's a little bit of a cop out, because he went on to say that in the context of Brexit, where we're trying to form closer trade relationships with China, that this might somehow be a good thing. This might somehow be part of that narrative. I don't see any of that self-righteousness in this content sharing. I think they're looking for readers. They're looking to widen their editorial network, which is essentially focused on the things that make money, which are clickbait. So rather than funding good journalism by doing it, they're taking content that will give them access to a new market, and an enormous market with a tremendous amount of money, and probably looking to make close relationships, launch a mail out there. I think, as Matt said, there's a commercial interest at play here. I don't think it's about covering more Chinese stories better. And I certainly think the trade deal, which was referenced by their editorial chief, is one of the most irrelevant factors to this coverage.
Tom Lewis, it's funny, when you look at this from an American perspective, this is actually not that unusual. It's, you know, quite often you'll open the Washington Post or even the New York Times and see that inserted there is an eight-page insert that happens to be the English language version of Pravda, or of a Chinese newspaper as well. It's not unusual in that sense, is it?
No, it's not that unusual, and I think, you know, that doesn't mean that the sort of, you know, kind of moral kind of quagmire, I suppose, kind of isn't as kind of relevant there as well. I mean, I think, you know, this kind of idea of sort of sharing stories both with kind of maybe partners that you would think are sort of slightly more dubious than others is quite a long-standing thing in the US and the Canadian media by now. And I think it sort of posed quite interesting sort of challenges. You look at the Canadian press, which is the national newswire here. Now they're, you know, I think one of the strongest newswires sort of in this part of the world. They are always at every story, every scene, and they are, you know, reporting from the front and investing in those stories too. And those stories then filter out to newspapers, to websites, you know, across the country and further afield sometimes too. Now, I think, like Josh said, I mean, it's a slightly depressing thing where, you know, if you're going to say that you want to sort of cover stories and that this is some great editorial kind of move, then, you know, frankly, sort of prove that. And I just don't think this kind of partnership does at all. I mean, it's an easy way to get more material online, surely, without really asking the other questions that this kind of raises.
There we are. It doesn't get the Thomas Lewis seal of approval. We will leave things there just for now. Matt Alagai, Josh Fennett, Tom Lewis will be back with me in just a moment.
The Monocle Weekly, our original Sunday show, brings you the best interviews with the writers, artists, thinkers, and innovators that shape our times. Also featuring fearless presenters.
It's not illegal, but it does have an effect.
Uh-oh. Are you ready for this, Tom?
I could do with some stimulation and some relaxation. How traumatised am I going
to
be?
How much of this do we need to drink to get an effect?
All of it.
Who ask the probing questions.
What is the kinkiest animal?
The mantis.
That's pretty kinky.
Headless, thrusting.
And a good old-fashioned star turn or two, just for good measure.
We had a small editorial conference today where everyone was going, what do you think of Kylie's concert? When did you go? When are you going? What's happening?
So, yeah, I heard you guys had a debrief.
Yeah, we've had a debrief.
That's the Monocle Weekly. Sundays at 12 noon London time on Monocle 24. You wouldn't want to finish your week without it.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Matt Alagaya, Josh Fennett, and in the Toronto Bureau, Thomas Lewis. Now, Josh, we're going to talk design now. And we've got a couple of things that you wanted to air in this arena today. One of which I know you're particularly passionate about, and I believe indeed your column in the next issue is about this issue, London as a design city.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in this post-Brexit world of uncertainty as these kind of storm clouds mass and gather over London, I think there's actually a reasonably positive narrative about the design industry in the city, how people within it, architects, people who are organising exhibitions, are showing a more worldly view than, unfortunately, the poll, which means that we will have to leave the EU, leaves people thinking about London. And I think that draws down to a few different openings. So one that couldn't have escaped many people's attention is Herzog and de Meuron, who have redesigned an extension to the Tate Modern Art Museum. One job which I, for one, am very glad a couple of Europeans got. The Swiss architecture practice have done an excellent job.
Although what's actually interesting about that as well is that even their work there was affected by the financial crisis in actually what turned out to be quite a good way, because it's a quite striking structure but made of brick, whereas originally it was going to be a sort of a glass and steel thing which would perhaps be more in keeping with the horrible towers that have sprung up next to the Tate Modern rather than the Tate Modern itself.
I mean, I'll be honest, I think it's a 10-storey, 65-metre tall monument to what makes British cultural clout worth visiting. It increases the size of the Tate Modern by some 60%. It also couldn't be more British if it was made by a Cockney bricklayer whistling knees up Mother Brown. To be honest, even though it's been done by Swiss architecture practice, it references Giles Gilbert Scott's original power station that was completed there in the 60s, like you mentioned, the kind of perforated brick surface, references the exact way that the museum was built in the first place. And I just think it's an incredible thing, and it really underlines what London's good at: getting people in, allowing people to linger, being a place where ideas, great exhibitions, designs and architects are allowed to do their own thing. This is complemented, or will be complemented, in September, just 2 miles up the Muddy Thames at Somerset House, where we'll have the inaugural London Biennale, which is where 37 nations will host individual pavilions around the idea of utopia. And utopia in the post-Brexit world seems like a bit of a strange term.
Well, no, but also maybe quite a good thing for London to be focusing on.
But again, it's just this positive thing where they're encouraging people from Belgium to set up an exhibition about what we should do about all the plastic in our seas. They're asking people from Greece to talk about, you know, what kind of future they want to build out of the rubble of the present day of the project that they're kind of embroiled in. Then we have the Design Museum coming up in Kensington by British architect John Pawson in a beautiful 1960s former banana warehouse. That's anticipated to bring some 400,000 people a year in. So again, we've just got these great examples come to fruition after Brexit, probably commissioned before Brexit, that show London has the capacity to be a world-leading city, to invite people in, to inspire people, and to be a place where people are able to have a debate across international borders.
Well, that's the thing about it, isn't it? As Josh says, all of these things were planned pre-Brexit, and they're obviously all going to continue, and obviously London will remain an international city because, you know, it will, in the same way that New York is an international city, and yet, you know, people from Belgium still have to get a visa to go there, or at least a visa waiver thing to go there. So, I mean, are you hopeful that, you know, as Josh is saying, in the design world, actually there are things that London can still say, you know, we're here, we're international, and we're going to continue doing what we're doing?
Absolutely. I think it's amazing that you're absolutely right that, you know, these projects were commissioned years ago, but it's almost perfect kind of poetic justice that they've come to fruition now. And, you know, the Design Museum by John Pawson looks absolutely stunning. That's going to open in November. And, you know, that's going to be one of the world leading design museums now. And it has to be here. I think it's great that, you know, London is so inextricably linked to the rest of the world that it will never be a kind of an island. And, you know, even though, yeah, we have voted for Brexit, I think London as a city is still, you know, arguably one of the best cities in Europe.
Tom Lewis, from a Canadian, indeed from a North American perspective, do you share Matt's enthusiasm, optimism, indeed from Josh as well, that London will still be it will still have that international stature when it comes to things like design and culture?
I think it will, absolutely. And I think, you know, after the results of the vote back in June, I went to Montreal to discuss the effect of, you know, separatist referenda there. And Montreal, obviously, as we've discussed at length on Monocle 24 in the past few weeks, you know, was the powerhouse city of Canada. Arguably, it is no longer the powerhouse city in the same way today. But I was speaking to some independent business leaders there and entrepreneurs who'd set up in the wake of the shifts happening in Montreal, and they said quite clearly that, you know, this changing, you know, of the economic guard, if you like, in Montreal over the past, say, 30, 40 years, actually one of the major beneficiaries was the arts, and that artists flocked there, continue to do so, and that it really has become one of the key tenets of Montreal's economy now, and one of the major players, if you like, of what brings people in. So from a, you know, annual street art festival, which is one of the most respected in the world, to, you know, fireworks festivals, to, you know, independent galleries, that kind of thing. You know, Montreal is really kind of the place to be in Canada. And you get a lot of North America, you know, US sort of visitors coming to Montreal for that reason too.
Tom, we're going to have to stop you there, talk about Montreal.
Sorry.
No, that's all right. That's all right. We've got 90 seconds left. I want to talk about really old sharks, which I'm told that Josh is an expert on. Josh, okay, here's a question for you. Is that, right, the former vertebrate record holder, the oldest vertebrate in the world ever, was the bowhead whale. How many years old was it?
211.
Good work. You know your stuff.
I did my research before. You weren't expecting me to get that.
Fine. What's the new record holder?
He's over 400 years. He's James I's rule, so my British history is not all that. But he's got a couple of hundred years under his belt, doesn't he?
Well, indeed, arguably, he might be 507 years old, called Ming.
I will not take that argument with you.
Okay, there we are. Greenland sharks is what we're talking about, Matt Allagaier. And it's been revealed, new research has shown that they are the oldest vertebrate animal in existence. 500 years, what do you think we can learn from this?
Well, I mean, we can certainly learn...
The big takeaways, yeah, Matt. Exactly.
Sharks are obviously incredibly old. That's probably, I think, the main lesson here. That's interesting.
Thanks for your insight there, Matt Alagaya.
The way that they age these things is fascinating. And again, I'm going to have to defer to Josh, who has studied this in depth.
But... So when I saw this earlier, I hadn't realised that the way that they aged the sharks, because they've been around for so long, was to do with nuclear fallout in the marine food that they ate. So they gauged all of the nuclear tests that went on, including the nuclear bombs that went off in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and they were able to carbon date these sharks.
There we are. And if you want a final shark fact before we go, a shark reaches sexual maturity at the age of 150. On that note, Matt Alagar, Josh Fenner and Tom Lewis, thank you very much indeed. That was Midori House, not just for today, but for the week. It was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jimena Mignan. The studio manager was Kieran Matthew Benergi. There'll be music next. Then it's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. Later on tonight, Monocle Daily, 2200 London time. Midori House, back on Monday, 1800 here in London, 1300 in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.